Welcome to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you a special edition of The Green. The University of Delaware's journalism program recently launched a new speaker series, The Front Page Cafe, bringing journalists and other writers to UD to highlight their work and tell their stories. The series, inspired by UD's successful Science Cafe, held its inaugural event last month, welcoming Catherine Miles to the Deer Park Tavern to discuss her latest book, Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. In the book, Miles, who earned her doctorate in English at UD in 2001, hit the road to look at where the next devastating earthquake in the U.S. will happen and how prepared communities across the country are for it and its aftermath. Miles also writes for Outside Magazine, Politico, and also authored the book Superstorm about Superstorm Sandy. Delaware Public Media is partnering with the UD Journalism Program to bring you Front Page Cafe and recorded this first edition on November 14th. In the first half hour, you'll hear Miles talk about her book and the issues it raised. In the second half hour, you'll hear the event's question and answer session. So sit back and enjoy the first Front Page Cafe with Catherine Miles, author of Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake.
Thank you all so much for coming out. It is so, 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 so great to be back here. I left in 2001, and I really haven't been back since then. The Deer Park was a very regular haunt of mine, and I would probably rather not calculate the amount of Yingling that I drank downstairs. And it's just so great to be back in this space, and back to a space that really, really, really matters to me. I was talking to some folks in the Department of Communication earlier about just how much this place and this community really matters to me and how much I've gained from being a part of it. So it really does feel like a homecoming of the very best kind, and I'm so glad to be here. As McKay mentioned, my last book, my most recent book, is a book called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. And I just want to tell you a little bit about how the book came to be, why I wrote it, a little bit about what I learned, and then as quickly as possible, I'd really like to turn it over to you to hear what you all have to say, answer any questions that you may have, and maybe just make this a little bit more of a conversation. So I think of myself first and foremost as an environmental writer, someone who's really interested in the relationships that we formulate with place. Whether that place is a built landscape or a natural landscape, whether it's the place that we call home or a place that we occupy, and who we are within that space. And that's been something that both drove my scholarly work when I was here at the university and absolutely drives my sort of popular work that I do right now. So I'm really interested in these relationships that people formulate. And when I was writing my second book, which was about the Irish famine, and it was about a tall ship called the Jeannie Johnston. And there were about 5,000 of these tall ships that ferried people between Ireland and North America during the height of the famine, about 5,000 of these ships. And overwhelmingly, they had mortality rates that superseded the mortality rates on slave ships. Some of these ships were losing 70, 75%, 80% of their passengers, in part because landlords paid to put starving Irish people on the ship. And then what happened was really nobody's concern. Whereas if you look at, for instance, the slave ships, those captains were by and large paid by how many slaves walked off the ships, right? So I was really interested in this. I was interested in what it has to say about land use, about monocropism, about pandemics, about human rights issues. And I was also keenly interested in the culture that people who sail on these tall ships. And there's still a small number of them around right now. And you know, they tend to be a kind of alternative crowd, a kind of drop out of society crowd, people who want to spend the rest of their lives working on these tall ships. So I was really interested in that, and I had sailed on a couple of these ships as part of my research, and was fascinated by this culture. And as Superstorm Sandy came up the coast, some of you may recall that the Bounty, a ship that was built in the likeness of the HMS Bounty, of the Mutiny of Bounty fame, had been built as sort of a perfect replica in order to make the 1960s film Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando. And this film, the ship had been in Connecticut, and the captain had decided to drive the ship directly into the storm, directly into the largest hurricane in recorded human history. The ship sank thanks to an incredibly harrowing rescue attempt by some very brave Coast Guard members. They were able to save all but two of the crew members of the ship. two people died. But the fact that about 16 people lived was utterly remarkable. And I was captivated by this. I was captivated by the question of, why would someone drive the ship into a hurricane? What is this all about? And that's what led to me writing my third book, Superstorm. And I really set about it as sort of a nautical tale of this, but I eventually realized that the tale is actually much bigger than that. It's much bigger than a question of why would a captain sail a ship into a storm. It's the same question of why would the mayor of New York City choose not to evacuate the city of New York City when a hurricane was bearing down on it? Why were other sorts of decisions made? And so it really quickly became, for me, a question of risk and how we manage risk as a culture and as a society. And as I was sort of winding down that book tour, my editor and I were talking, and we were like, you know, the thing that has resonated with people the most as we have done this work is questions of infrastructure and questions of preparedness. You know, how prepared are we? And, you know, the sort of rough draft answer to that question seemed to be, we're not very prepared. And so we thought, you know, look, you know, what happens with other natural disasters? We kind of looked at this with hurricanes. What about other natural disasters? What about, for instance, you know, something like an earthquake? And that was really the sort of research question that led me into this work. And if you think about something like, for instance, 2017, and you think about the natural disasters we've seen here, if you think about the sort of epic rainfall that befell Houston after Hurricane Hugo, something that nobody expected. If you think about Hurricane Maria, and I was just talking about the sort of continuing devastation that results of that. If you think about the wildfires out west, if you think about the 107 earthquakes, major earthquakes that our planet has seen, we're in this phase of just, you know, incredible natural disaster, right? And there are some really big questions we should be asking. First of all, to what degree are these disasters truly natural versus to what degree are these disasters precipitated or encouraged or complicated by us as humans? That's really interesting to me. To what degree are we ready to deal with these natural disasters? Can we be ready to deal with these natural disasters? These are the questions that are really interesting to me in my research, and they were what I sort of set out to take a look at. So I, you know, full disclosure, have no background in geology whatsoever. I have a PhD on an esoteric subject in English literature from the University of Delaware, which I'm very proud to have. And I've done some science writing, but I didn't have a background in geology. And so the first thing I had to do was really sort of apprentice myself in a very sort of basic, like, geology 101 way to kind of understand what's going on here. Incredibly complex theory. And then it became a question for me, how can I tell this story in a way that's meaningful for people? And I was talking about this with a journalism class earlier today. You know, how do we tell a story? It's one thing to want to tell a story because we have a story we want to tell. You know, that's one thing. But it's another thing, I think, to tell a story that people want to hear, that people are willing to read, that people might spend $27.95 on to read in hardcover form. And so that became a really big challenge for me. How could I tell this story? And so I thought and thought and thought, and with the help of a really great friend of mine, I finally decided that the way to approach this book was to take a road trip around the United States and take a look and kind of ask interesting people some questions about the degree to which we are prepared for these earthquakes, the degree to which we are prepared for any natural disaster. And what I learned was frankly fascinating and sometimes terrifying. And what people said to me over and over and over again in my research is like, listen, we don't know anything about earthquakes. And these are seismologists at the, you know, U.S. Geological Society. These are geophysicists at very fancy universities. And they're like, we don't know, you know. We don't know why they start. We don't know where they start. We don't know how they start. We don't know whether they're going to be big or small. We don't know where the next one's going to happen. You know, and so this presents unimaginable challenges for these scientists and, frankly, for the emergency managers and everything else. And this became really interesting to me. If we don't know whether or not it's coming, what do we do about it? You know? So I drove around and I went to places that you would expect. I went to places like, for instance, the area around the San Andreas Fault Zone. which, scientists say are the closest thing to certainty that we have about where a major earthquake might happen in our lifetime. And I talked to folks there. I went to Cascadia, which some of you may be aware of, as a result of Catherine Schultz's New Yorker article 2 years ago, where she was really sort of unpacking the possibility for a major earthquake and tsunami in Cascadia. And then I went to places that I had no idea were actually at risk for a significant earthquake. Places like Memphis, places like Washington, D.C., places like New York City, places like Salt Lake City, and started to look at this. And I began to understand that this is a much bigger, more pervasive threat than I think any of us realize. The USGS has successfully mapped 2,100 faults in the United States. They know about 2,100 faults. They say for every fault they know about, there's probably anywhere between 10 and 100 faults that they don't yet know about. And they say most of the faults that they don't know about are actually east of the Mississippi. And that's because if you take a look at the last 100 years where a lot of the seismic activity has occurred, it's been out west. And so we've understandably taken our very limited resources and invested them out west in terms of seismometers and seismograms and seismographic research. We've done very little in the East Coast. The last significant earthquake that happened in the East Coast, other than the earthquake in 2011 in Washington, D.C., was in 1883 in New York City. And that was, well before a lot of this research took place. It was certainly close to 100 years before science accepted that tectonic plates was a valid theory. And in fact, when that earthquake happened in 1883, the New York Times wrote this very sort of unfortunate front page op-ed where they said, "Stop the hysteria. This is ridiculous. Earthquakes don't happen out here. Don't worry about it. You're being unreasonable. It's not a problem." And I actually start my book, it's a little bit of a cheap shot at the New York Times, which I respect, but a cheap shot at the New York Times in this book where they're like, just forget about it, it's not an East Coast problem. But it is. It's absolutely an East Coast problem. And because it's not happened in a while, we kind of sort of forget about the way in which it can be a pervasive problem and what we should do. So in the book, I travel around to different communities and kind of take a look at the risk there and take a look not only what's at stake for that particular community, but what's at stake for the rest of us as well, too, because I think that's really important. And I was talking to some folks in Baltimore last night, and one of the sort of test cases that I presented to them that I'll mention to you all as well, because I think it's really interesting, is Memphis. Some of you may know that in 1811, 1812, Memphis had a series of 3 major earthquakes, as well as hundreds of moderate earthquakes, some of the biggest earthquakes that have ever befallen our country. And there are all these sort of apocryphal stories of like the Mississippi River flowing backwards and the Liberty Bell either ringing or cracking in Philadelphia and things like that. But the reality is that what we know is that these earthquakes, which we think measured around an 8.3, which makes it a very major earthquake, happened on this rift where the continent of the United States once tried to rip apart in 2 parts. And for some reason, it didn't all the way rip. And so instead, it became the Mississippi River Valley. And it became this area of pretty significant seismic weakness. And that on average, about every 500 years, there are these catastrophic earthquakes that happen in the area around Memphis. So if that were to happen today, the effect would be far larger than anything that would impact Memphis and St. Louis. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is the stuff that we don't tend to think about. Memphis, as it turns out, is the absolute trade hub of the United States. You've got the Mississippi River, which is still a surprisingly sort of populated conveyance of everything from petroleum and petrochemicals, grains, wheat, things like that. You've got one bridge, the DeSoto Bridge, Highway 40, where something like 40% of all of our commerce passes on any given day. Our trucking commerce passes over this one bridge. And then you've got the FedEx super hub, where close to 3 million packages every night fly in and land from all over the world, get sorted in this place called the Matrix onto other airplanes, and then ship out again. UPS's third largest hub is in Memphis as well. And so given all of this, the sort of like profound economic catastrophe that would happen were Memphis to go down is something that's so much bigger than Memphis, so much bigger than, frankly, even this country. And so, FEMA has designated this one of the greatest catastrophes that would befall our country. So I wanted to think about that. I wanted to think about places like New York City that are frankly overdue for earthquakes, you know, and think about what would happen in a place like New York City. And what we know is that even a moderate earthquake, one that has happened on average about every 100 years, the last one, 1883. So if, you know, math is any indicator, New York City could be 40 years overdue for a major earthquake. Even a moderate earthquake in New York City, which they've had historically once every 100 years, would create more rubble and devastation than September 11th. That's major. That's really big. And we know these things to be true. And so the question for me is first and foremost, okay, that's interesting, and I want to know about that, and I want to know what my threat is. But for me, the question that's really important now is, what do we do knowing that? And that for me is really important. And, you know, if history is any indication, it is never going to be the case that we can predict earthquakes. Some of you may be familiar with the story of the Italian earthquake a couple of years ago, where six seismologists and state geologists were imprisoned and charged with manslaughter because they had not accurately predicted that an earthquake was going to happen, right? This made major scientific news. It was a major problem. And the government of Italy was like, look, you had a responsibility to predict this. And the rest of the scientific community went berserk, and they were like, we can't predict earthquakes. Like, what are you asking us to do? You know, and we've tried really, really hard to predict earthquakes. Some people have anecdotal and experiential evidence that there is, for instance, interesting changes in the behaviors of snakes or birds or things like that. Some people suggest that radon levels fluctuate in a way that can be sort of attributed to seismic activity. But so far, we don't have anything that passes the test of scientific veracity where it comes from earthquake prediction. So we can't predict them. We don't know them. Every major earthquake that's happened in the United States in over 100 years has happened in a fault that we didn't know about, right? So, shit, right? Like, now what, right? And so what I really wanted to do with this book is try to answer that question of now what. And so a lot of what I did was try to spend time with first responders. Like, for instance, the National Guard of Tennessee that trains again and again and again for this sort of Memphis eventuality. And I wanted to kind of understand what we can do, if anything, as individuals, as households, as communities, to kind of confront this risk in a way that makes sense, right? Because my aim is not to leave you curled up in the fetal position, terrified and having lost your will to live. That is not my aim. But my aim is to say, listen, we can be a country, if we want to be, we can be a country that is proactive, right? Instead of a country that is reactive. And right now, we're a country that's really great at being reactive. You know, when you think about something like the devastation of Houston earlier this year, you know, there was an incredible response, right? People showed up to donate blood, they showed up to make donations, they showed up to help, they showed up to rebuild things. We're great at that. We love it when the Red Cross shows up in a place. We love it when Tide shows up with its mobile washing machines and lets people do their laundry. I was talking to a journalism class earlier, and I was saying that when asked, the state of New Hampshire donated something like 3 tractor trailer loads worth of teddy bears to send to Puerto Rico. We're like, we want to help. But we're not good so far at being front-end focused. We're not good so far at being preventative and thinking about things that we can do to minimize impact when it happens. And, you know, if I had a wish that I could make to the sort of policy gods, it would be for us to make that shift and for us to start thinking about preparedness and conscious decisions about sustainability and resilience so that if a natural disaster of any sort strikes, and we know it will, that the devastation is far less significant, that the casualties are far less significant, and that we come back in a far greater way. And so with these last two books, that was a lot of what I was doing. I was saying, listen, what is it that we can do? You know, for decades and decades and decades, since World War II, frankly, we have profoundly underfunded our infrastructure as a country. The American Society of Civil Engineers gives us a report card every 3 years on our infrastructure. And for the last like 9 or 12 years, we've gotten a D minus, you know, on our roads, our bridges, our levees, our airports, our power grid. These are all really outmoded systems. And they don't have to be. They could be awesome, you know. when we look at things like tsunami warning and tsunami monitoring systems, when we look at things like an early warning system, some of you may remember the Mexico earthquake from earlier this year. You know, it happened on the day, the anniversary of the 1985 earthquake, which since 1985, Mexico has designated a National Earthquake Preparedness Day. And every day on that date, all of Mexico drills on an earthquake. And at noon that day, all of Mexico drills on what to do for an earthquake. Mexico instituted the first national early warning system in the world, which is robust and has, you know, both alarms that are sort of, you know, sirens that go off in communities and also handheld, you know, cellular device technology that says, hey, listen, an earthquake's coming. It's going to be a magnitude 7.1. You've got 45 seconds to take cover. And 45 seconds is a ton of time when it comes to an earthquake. 45 seconds is enough time for you to make decisions that may well be the decision between life or death. We have that technology here in the United States. We are ready to go with that technology, but we do not have congressional funding for that technology. And a question I have is why? Why are we not willing to spend what is a fairly small amount by federal standards on a national warning system that would give people the time to get ready? Why are we not drilling? Why are we not building communities that are based on cooperation and coalition? Why, you know, why as a household, how many of you here have a go bag? Okay, you get a gold star for a night and a free drink. We should all have go bags. We should all have a duffel bag at home that has a week's worth of water and food and a first aid kit and some warm clothes, and none of us have it. Why? Because we honestly think it won't happen to us. And I hold myself, I am not standing up here as some sanctimonious person. Like, truth be told, I don't really have a go bag. That's embarrassing, but I'll tell you, since we're all among friends, I should have a much better go bag. I just said to my partner the other day, he lives in Portsmouth, he's like an hour away from me. And I was like, how would we find each other? He's like, I don't know. I'm like, what would we do? And he's like, I don't know. I'm like, don't you think we should know? You know, he's got my cell phone memorized. I don't have his cell phone memorized. It's just on my phone. I just call Bill, you know? I'm like, I don't know what his number is, you know? This is the sort of thing that we can all be doing. We should all have a plan. And I think this plan is important not only when, you know, sort of push comes to shove, but because it also gives us a sense of empowerment. It gives us a sense that there are things that we can do. When I wrote Superstorm, I interviewed a high-ranking official at the Coast Guard, and I was asking him about this idea of risk and why it is that we so often sort of underestimate the role of natural risk. And he had one of my very favorite quotes that I've ever used in a story. He said, listen, Mother Nature plays to win, and she'll beat you every time. And that is a true statement. And it is a statement that we don't want to acknowledge is true. We would love it if it were the case that we could beat Mother Nature. And we try sometimes and we think we've got it. But the fact of the matter remains that in the end, you know, she's going to win, you know. And not only is she going to win, but she's frankly being helped by us. You know, and when you think about things like, for instance, human-induced seismicity, whether it's earthquakes being caused by wastewater injection, fracking, things like that, we are single-handedly changing the face of risk on this planet in some really disturbing ways. And that is one more reason for us to be willing to invest in these sort of models of resiliency so that we can make sure that we and the people that we love are safe. And we can. You know, we cannot prevent the next hurricane from happening. We cannot prevent the next earthquake from happening. But we can take steps to make sure that we not only survive it, but that we bounce back really fast. And hey, here's an idea. We even bounce back even stronger than we were before. And so that's my kind of soapbox message lately. Like, let's invest in those sorts of things. Let's invest in community. Let's invest in infrastructure. Let's invest in policies and procedures and mechanisms that make us more efficient, that make us more community-based, that make us able to kind of step out of this kind of disaster response model into a sort of disaster preparedness model, which is also just a really good planning model. So that's the political statement for the night.
That's Catherine Miles, author of Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake, discussing her book at last month's inaugural Front Page Cafe, sponsored by UD's journalism program, UD's Science Cafe, and the University of Delaware's Department of English. The Front Page Cafe will continue in a moment with the question and answer session from last month's event. Stay with us. You're listening to Delaware Public Media.